This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Her voice is well known to WVXU and NPR listeners from her frequent appearances on the weekend quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Now she's bringing her four decades of comedy experience to Cincinnati. I spoke with Paula Poundstone earlier. Paula Poundstone, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You've got an upcoming show at the Taft Theater. Have you been to Cincinnati before?
I have. I've been to the Taft Theater before.
Yeah, it's a great old venue.
I've been to Cincinnati. I know the trick about how the airport's not even in the state of Ohio. I know it all.
Yeah, that's a great trick. A lot of people get confused that they're in Kentucky for most of the drive into downtown. So you're a familiar voice to WVXU listeners because of your frequent appearances on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 3 here. What do you like about that program?
You know what? The first time I ever did that show, we didn't used to do it in front of a live audience. We used to do it. We were all in studios, you know, whatever one was nearest to us. Peter was in Chicago. I was in L.A. Carl was in D.C., et cetera. We were just hooked up via wire. But, the director can talk to you on the wire thing in your ear. They don't talk to you often while you're trying to work, but they do sometimes. And so the first time I was on, I was very kind of shy. You know, I wasn't quite sure what to do. And the director kept coming on going, jump in anytime, say whatever you want. And I got to tell you, that is almost unheard of in, in any kind of recorded entertainment industry. It's all suits wanting to tell you what to do. But these guys, they hire people, embrace yourself, then they let them do their job.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
It sounds like you have a lot of fun.
So it is fun. So what you end up with is really a free-for-all. That comment, you guys sound like you're having fun, I hear that from lots of people, and I can tell you honestly, we are.
Awesome. Yeah, my friend Emily, I'm being selfish here, but my friend Emily's a big fan of yours, and I said, give me a question to ask her. And what she wanted to know was, who's your favorite person to appear with on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Oh, I don't know. They're all fun for different reasons, I guess. I will say that... Peter Gross made me laugh so hard one time that we had to stop the show. And everyone was just waiting for me to recover. There's lots of really funny people on there. I love Adam Felber. I love Tom Baudet. I love Amy Dickinson. They're all fun.
Yeah, it's a great cast.
But yeah, I think Peter Gross does hold the record for making me laugh so hard.
Awesome. So you've been doing stand-up now for almost, 40 years?
Going to be 40 years in the spring.
Wow.
I don't know if that's my phone or yours making that horrible noise.
Oh, that's all right. I think it might be on your end, but we'll get that cleared up somehow.
Oh, okay.
So that long in the business, how do you compare your sets now to the ones you did back in the earlier days?
You know, they're real similar in lots of ways, honestly. They're largely autobiographical. It's sort of a mixture of two things. It's a mixture of me, talking about, what I'm up to in this part of my life, and then it's a mixture of just talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living, and in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge. The difference is that now I have, 40 years, almost 40 years of material rattling around somewhere in my head, not only material, but also sort of experiences, and, I had less of that when I was younger. And I think when I was just starting out, I really saw being unscripted as somehow unprofessional, that it was a liability, I thought. And then somewhere along the way, I realized, geez, the really funny stuff that I say is when I don't have a plan. And, it sounds so Trump-like that I'm hesitant to say it when he was saying the other day that, it was unscripted, got him elected president. Let me just say that my unscripted would not get me elected president.
I think that's probably safe to say, but who knows anymore?
Nor should it.
But
it does. I mean, I think when I unshackled myself, when I said, I'm just going to go and kind of feel the room out, which isn't to say that I don't have any, I have sort of a skeleton in my head of, it's not even, well, maybe skeleton is too detailed as well. But there's a couple of milestones within my set that I might hit. That's all.
Yeah. So it's like a lot of improv is injected into the performance.
Yeah. Yeah. And then people could come two nights in a row and not see the same show, although there may be a couple of pieces of material that they would have heard on both nights.
So some well-known comedians have complained about political correctness and the like when performing these days. Do you find the current culture difficult for stand-up at all?
Yes. Having said that, I think sometimes, and not always, there are times where certain groups have been used as sort of laugh lines or whipping boys. I hope that I never did that. But there is that possibility. And I think, so one of the things that's happened in recent years is that people have gone, wait a minute. Why should we have to, how come that should be us? And that's perfectly reasonable to me. I'm so sick of people retweeting something that they thought was offensive. I'm like, well, if it was offensive, why would we want to look at it again? You know, but the truth is they don't think it's offensive. What it is provocative. So, I don't know. I remember I started out in Boston and I worked there as a stand-up for about a year before I, took a Greyhound bus around the country to see what clubs were like in different cities. And I ended up in San Francisco. And one of the things that I noticed very early on in San Francisco, I mean, people made gay jokes in Boston for sure, but there wasn't a big gay following that came out to the clubs. Whereas in San Francisco, when people make gay jokes, there'd be a bunch of gay people sitting in the audience. And I remember thinking, what's wrong with this picture? You know, that I wanted everyone who came out for the night to feel safe that they were at no time going to be the punchline in that stereotypical way. And so, you know, I focused on that. Now, the truth is, you can't walk a mile in everybody's shoes because it's just not possible. And so does that mean that, you know, I might say something sometimes that was sort of insensitive to one group or another? Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There's always that possibility. And the other thing is, you have to keep in mind the spirit of something that someone says. And that, you know, social networking has no context.
And so, you're writing about people's happiness now. You've got a new book out, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. What can you tell us about how humans find happiness now?
Well, this was really, really the study. What I did was experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. And by the way, happy is different than enjoying something.
Okay.
I was looking for a bounce. I was looking for, a storage of happiness so that when I return to the struggles of my regular life of being a parent and raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day, I was looking for what could I be doing that would, that would leave me with something to attack the rest of my life with. So I tried many things. I have to say, the first thing I did was the Get Fit experiment. And every chapter is written as an experiment with the conditions and the hypothesis and the variables, et cetera. The analysis part of each chapter was reflecting on how my regular life was going. And so in the end, A, it's a funny book, and B, it's the story of really several years of my life raising my children. And the first experiment that I did was the Get Fit experiment, where I worked out for several months. Never more than one a day, but I did as many. I went to a Taekwondo self-defense guy for as many days as I could, given my schedule. Some weeks it was five times, some weeks it was one time. Anyways, over the course of 7 months, and I have to say, we've been told it our whole lives that if you exercise, you feel better. I was just hoping it wasn't true. I was hoping it was sitting in a chair eating Doritos. That was my fondest desire. It's interesting. Some of the things that we typically think will make us happy, like Americans have a thing about, you know, fancy cars, fancy sports cars. So I did rent a Lamborghini.
Oh, wow.
Just for 24 hours. It was fun for a few minutes here and there. But there was an overwhelming burden to it. Part of it is if I, you know, put a scratch on that car, I was in big trouble.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing was, you know, of course, it's an environmental nightmare. And I don't know. Even when every now and then, like a lot during that 24 hours, people would yell, "Nice car." And I thought, you know, what, I would yell back, "It's not mine." Just, why would I want to be defined by that? I wanted to go, you know, I'm a nice person. I don't know.
But one of the experiments you did also was you hugged a bunch of people.
Yes, I did. I did. I decided to do 24 hours of hugging everyone that I met. Now, I have to say that this experiment got modified as the day went on. For one thing, because I had to fly to work that day.
Uh-oh.
And I'll tell you, the TSA does not like hugging. I am on the national do not hug list right now as a result.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're very tense about that.
They're into grabbing, not so much hugging.
Right. Yeah. It's more of a one-sided thing.
So
you know, I am always in the pat-down line, by the way. I don't know why.
Well,
I am always. Such that now when they say to me, you know, you're going to get the pat-down, I, with a big smile on my face, I go, "I know." And that makes them uncomfortable.
They must have heard about your car.
Yeah, right.
So your popularity grew when you served as a Tonight Show correspondent during the 1992 presidential election party conventions. You still comment frequently on political matters on Twitter. What do you think is different about today's political climate when you think back to those days in 1992?
I think the entire country has collectively hit its head on a rock. I'm not sure how it happened. One thing that's very different is social media being a part of the whole thing. And the Russians, you know, found that soft spot. I firmly believe a lot of, because I noticed even the climate in my show changed after the election. It was different than it was during the campaign, even. And I don't know about now, but I have traditionally, in the past anyways, had a mixed crowd, probably more Democrats than Republicans, but not exclusively by any means. And we all laughed, you know, there were things that are funny. There's things that we all have in common, but this weird idea that we're so separate, really seems to be something that maybe it was, maybe it was an opportunistic infection, you know. Maybe we were ripe for it. But boy, I really firmly believe that the Russians' social media campaign has been very, very effective in making people, separate and angry. And because outside of that, I mean, what we have is hopefully something that will be addressed using the RICO laws, but. I don't know why that would make everyone mad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Other than, it's weird. It's really weird. And this idea that it sort of boils down to these identities, that I don't understand either. But anyways, that has changed things. You know, I wasn't, during Watergate, I wasn't old enough to pay attention to those kinds of things. I don't, like, my parents voted for Nixon. And they were, you know, they were Republicans. They didn't talk about politics a lot anyways. But I don't remember at what point in his process that they went, "Wait a minute." Or if they ever even did. I have no idea. I never asked them. Never came up. And my kids are like dripping in politics when they're around me because I can't shut up about it. But my parents,
yeah. Well, you've been immersed in it for much of your public life. And a lot of people might not remember this, but in 1992, you hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and you were the first woman to do that. And you are outspoken as a Democrat or a liberal. And I read that before you went on to do that gig, you were called to the White House to meet with the Republican president, George H.W. Bush. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was so, I don't know, looking back, maybe I was a better person than I am now. I don't know. But at the time, when I first got asked to do the job, first of all, I was not even familiar with what it was. But at the time, and I have to also, it was different. The event of the White House Correspondents' Dinner was different then than it is now. I mean, this last year when, I don't know, when Michelle, what's her name, was there, the comic, Michelle Wolf.
Yes.
I remember I was in a hotel room on the day of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and on like MSNBC and CNN, they were covering it as if it were the Oscars or something. They had like a red carpet. They were, they had somebody out there interviewing people as they came into the room. They didn't do that in 92. It was much more of an event that was to entertain the White House correspondents. It wasn't really to entertain the entire nation of, I mean, did people see the performances? Yeah, but you'd see it on the news later. You wouldn't see it live. You might not even see the whole thing. You might just see clips of it. It just plain wasn't, it sort of gotten blown out of proportion in terms of what it is. But anyway, so I got invited to do this, and the head of the Correspondents Association at that time was White House correspondent, was Charles Bierbauer from CNN. And he's the guy who hired me. And I said to him when he first brought it up, I was like, no, I don't think that's a good idea. And he came and he watched my whole set. He said, no, I think it'll be good. And so then I let my ego get the better of me. And I said, okay, I'll do that. But I was very firm. I was very firm. I was young. Keep that in mind.
Sure.
I was very firm that I did not want to have any pictures taken with the president. I was a Democrat. I felt very strongly about not wanting to be allied with this Republican president. And so the day of the show comes, or maybe it was the day before, I can't remember anymore, and I arrive at the hotel, and the message light, back when there was such a thing, on the phone at the hotel is on, and I call the front desk, and they say, the White House calling. And I forget, I guess I called the White House back, and I was in, George Bush, the first George Bush, wanted to meet with me at the White House. I cannot tell you how quickly I stashed my spine under my bed and flew to the White House. And he said at one point, let's take some pictures. I'm like, yeah. I know.
Well, who could resist?
Nothing. But I called Charles Bierbauer and I said, oh my God, the president has called to meet with me. And I was kind of freaked out. And he said, oh, he just wants to soften you. He wants to make sure what you're going to, about what you're going to say. And the truth is, I met with the guy, we were probably hanging around together for an hour, and he never mentioned anything of the sort. And so finally, just before, we were parting ways, I said, gee, Mr. President, you must have had some reason you wanted to talk to me. And I suggested that it was because he wanted to, make sure of what I was going to say. And he said, oh, nah. He said, all's fair and, all's fair in love and war. He says, you say whatever you want. He said, I just want to, the last guy that did this job, it was very blue. And I said, oh, well, I'm not generally very blue. So and then he was like, whatever,
So anyway. So
it
now.
Was very exciting, but it was not. And by the way, it's a lousy job as a performer. I mean, all the fun is the stuff surrounding it. Once you do the performance, entertaining the White House correspondents, it's horrible. They're like the people from, remember His Girl Friday?
Sure.
Yeah, they're like these hard-boiled, seen that, done that kind of people, I mean, they weren't smoking during the event, I'm sure, but you could picture them like cigarettes coming out of the side of their mouth and tossing back, a whiskey. They're really just these sort of hard-boiled characters that are not easy to entertain at all.
Yeah, and so now the White House Press Association has gotten rid of comedians doing this because I guess the Michelle Wolf was too hard on President Trump and his administration. I was wondering what your take on that might be.
I think that the event itself does not know what it wants to be. And so, the truth is, I've done, I've done probably easily 500 fundraisers in my day, and I've done them in many cities, mostly Los Angeles, but many cities. And, or like private events like that. I don't even know if that's a fundraiser. I don't know what it is. But at those kinds of events, you can only do maybe three things effectively. Are people eating and talking? Are they being entertained? Are you making a statement? Are you raising money? Are you networking? Are you making your, you know, organization better known? What are you doing? And you can only do three of those things effectively. And so I think when the event itself decides what it is, it'll get back on the rails. But, you know, the truth is, I mean, Mark Russell, I think, was the first comic ever to do it, and I think he did it for a number of years. And I'll bet you he entertained them. But they, you know, I remember when Clinton was in office, he hired Imus. And then everybody bellyached that, you know, Imus said inappropriate things. Well, gee, I never liked Imus. Why would you have met Imus?
Well, what do you expect?
He said inappropriate things. And the same thing, I'm sure, for Michelle Wolf. I'll bet you, despite her last name, I'll bet you she didn't come in sheep's clothing. I'll bet they knew who she was the whole while. So somebody thought that was a great idea.
Yeah, she had a sharp tongue and a nice smoky eye, if I recall.
Yeah, not Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but I mean, you know, when you think about it too, you know, the sort of pretend outrage about it, like Michelle Wolf made fun of Sarah Huckabee Sanders' eye makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that time, when they were doing that event, I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. If it wasn't that day, then it was in the right around that time. The first of the caravan,
like the migrants,
asylum seekers, right? We're beginning to show up at the border, and in very short order after that, you know, there many of them had their children, you know, literally ripped from their arms and imprisoned. You know, so which is the bigger outrage again? You know, we're paying all this attention to Michelle Wolf and whether or not Sarah Huckabee Sanders' feelings were hurt, and yet we are devastating the lives of, you know, I don't really care about Sarah Huckabee Sanders' eye makeup.
People can be very selective about their outrage. But hey, one more thing before you go. I know you've got a busy day. You've had this long, successful career with stand-up specials, big appearances, books, and more. You've even got this great podcast out now, Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. But is there something you haven't gotten to do yet that you still want to do?
Oh, I want to be in the movie Bridesmaids. And I don't know how they would do that.
Maybe there'll be a sequel.
I know, I don't want to be in the sequel. I want to be in the original.
Oh, okay.
So it'll take time travel. I think that is the funniest movie ever made. I would like to work in some sort of ensemble, comedy movie,
yeah.
I think. And I would like to write a screenplay, but, you know, I'd like to go into space as well. So I may be talking about skills that I simply don't have. But you asked.
Well, hey, wherever you end up, I'm sure your fans will follow. And Paula Poundstone, we do appreciate you joining us. We're going to see you when you come to Cincinnati.
All right. Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Likewise. See ya.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.